NBC News Radio, I'm Mike Vaccaro at the White House. Mitt Romney is off the campaign trail today, but he's taking plenty of shots as pressure grows for him to release more of his personal financial information.
He could be confirmed as dog catcher, because a dog catcher, you at least don't want to look at his income tax returns.
That's Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who is often critical of Romney. But this weekend, the GOP presidential nominee also took some heat from his side of the aisle. Alabama Governor Robert Bentley told the AP, if you have things to hide, then maybe you're doing things wrong. Bentley has since said those comments were taken out of context. A wildfire is threatening 170 homes in Northern California. State forestry officials say the fire is burning in a steep, heavily wooded area about 50 miles northeast of Sacramento. The International Committee of the Red Cross says it now considers the conflict in Syria a civil war. That means international humanitarian aid applies throughout the country. This is NBC News Radio. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton meets today with the head of Egypt's army as the U.S. seeks to have the nation's military and new civilian government work together. Clinton's demand to the military will be simple: cooperate with Egypt's new Islamist leaders on a full transition to civilian rule. A Yemeni security official says a suspected al-Qaeda militant accidentally set off a bomb he was preparing in the capital. He killed himself and injured one other person. A crowd at Comic-Con got a sneak peek of Peter Jackson's new Hobbit movie.
If reaction to the Hobbit footage at Comic-Con is any indication, Peter Jackson has another couple of blockbusters on his hands. The crowd went wild over a 12-minute reel the filmmaker screened. The 3D epic, which is a prequel to Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy, is broken into two films. I'm Veronica Dela Cruz, NBC News Radio.
Authorities say a man whose prized sports car was stolen 42 years ago has it back after spotting it on eBay. I'm Mike Vaccaro, NBC News Radio.
Now you can dial a diamond and save half by calling Empire Diamond at 1-800-SAVE-HALF. Over 70 years in the Empire State Building, they'll sell diamonds wholesale without a middleman's markup. That's right, GIA-graded diamonds at half the price of famous high-end jewelers. Qualified buyers may have diamonds into their home or office for a free 10-day no-obligation inspection and get a 60-day money-back guarantee. So save half on your diamonds. Visit at dialadiamond.com or call 1-800-SAVE-HALF. That's 1-800-SAVE-HALF.
Roofing Pros. Right now at the Home Depot, buy a pallet of GAF shingles, including Timberline shingles with a lifetime limited warranty, and get your entire order, the shingles and any other supplies you need, delivered to your job site for free. You'll eliminate time-wasting supply runs and take your productivity through the roof, thanks to free delivery with any pallet of GAF shingles. More saving, more doing. That's the power of the Home Depot. Valid through August 15th, U.S. only. See store for details.
Hey everybody, it's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show.
Join us on Sunday, July 15th. We'll be sipping and slurping some sake in studio with the team from Pabu in Baltimore, and we'll be doing an in-studio demo with L'Académie de Cuisine.
That's Foodie and the Beast, next Sunday at 11, live right here on 1500 AM.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
Job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview.
Yeah.
And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. And I'm joined by my co-host, Ted Sullivan, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. And we've got a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including Ann Harkins. Ann is the president and CEO of the National Crime Prevention Council. Jim Boland, president of Boland. Jeff Studley, co-founder and president of CPR Multimedia Solutions. And Chris Bergen, CEO, president, CEO, and publisher of Tax Analyst. So let's get started. Here's our first guest. Her name is Ann Harkins. She's the president and CEO of the National Crime Prevention Council. Ann, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
And what is the National Crime Prevention Council?
The National Crime Prevention Council is the home of McGruff the Crime Dog.
Officer McGruff?
Officer McGruff. McGruff.
Oh, just McGruff. I guess I gave him a promotion.
You can.
See, I imagine almost everyone knows who McGruff is, but for those who don't, who is McGruff the Crime Dog?
McGruff the Crime Dog has become an American icon. He celebrates his 32nd birthday this coming Saturday, July 1st. He was created at the time by the Justice Department and some private philanthropists because people in this country, it's hard to believe today, but 30 years ago, people did not know there were things they could do to prevent crime. If you asked people, they would say, I can't prevent a crime. That's the job of law enforcement.
Right.
Well, crime at the time was on the rise, and the department, in conjunction with the Ad Council, started a program to educate the public that there are things they can do to prevent crime. And we know we moved the needle because today, 75% of Americans know there are things they can do to prevent a crime. And McGruff has been a huge part of that.
And McGruff's saying is what?
Take a bite out of crime.
Now the campaign that originated pre-McGruff, there was something pre-McGruff, was there not?
You know, McGruff is actually the first piece of the campaign. We start with ads that we call the lights, locks, and alarm ads,
okay,
telling people to keep their homes locked, to have lights outside, to tell a trusted neighbor if they know they're going out of town. All those simple things, common sense things that you can do to keep yourself and your home safe. Take a bite out of crime means that everybody, whether they're 6 or 106, can do some things to keep themselves safe.
Wow, it sounds like McGruff is even bigger than Smokey the Bear.
McGruff is right up there with Smokey the Bear. McGruff and Smokey the Bear and the crash dummies are,
yes,
seatbelt dummies, are among the top 5 Ad Council campaigns in the history of that program.
Now, I just want to make one thing clear, that this is not public service announcements anymore. This is different.
Well, we still do public service advertising, but I prefer today to call it public education.
Education.
And the reason is that the world of public service advertising has changed. But in addition to that, we help people prevent crime, every demographic you can think of, from 6-year-olds in McGruff Club to kits to help seniors keep themselves safe.
Wow.
Every crime you can think of, we still talk about home safety and protecting yourself from burglary, to cyberbullying and intellectual property theft.
You gave us an example in the green room about something about a school, I never would have thought of. Tell us about that.
Be Safe and Sound in School is a program that the National Crime Prevention Council conducts, and it is designed to help keep a school safe, but we take it from two perspectives. You have the physical plant of the school, crime prevention through environmental design,
like
where
what?
You put lights, where you put doors, how you control access to the school. All those things are part of what we call SEPTED.
Okay.
But Be Safe and Sound in School combines those basic hard targeting principles, if you will, with developing and promoting a culture of respect in school so that you're reducing the likelihood of bullying and cyberbullying in the school.
So how long have you been with National Crime Prevention Council?
In some respects, it depends on how you count, because I worked on the Senate Judiciary Committee for many years, and these crime prevention programs were part of our jurisdiction. But I've actually been with the National Crime Prevention Council for 6 years, 3 years as president.
And you've had a passion for this type of work for how long?
Well, really, since I was probably a late teenager. My dad was a federal law enforcement official, and brought a lot of common sense to everything he did. And crime prevention helps people and saves money, so we should all be for it.
So your dad was, what, a federal ranger, FBI? What was
he? He was a postal inspector.
Okay, so I got to stop you here. That is one of those phrases that everybody's heard, and on some level you think of a Seinfeld episode or something like that. What did your dad do as a postal inspector?
Well, he had an almost 50-year career with the postal service, including World War II. But he worked in the United States Post Office when he started. In order to be an inspector, and the inspectors are essentially the law enforcement arm of the postal service, we would say today, than the U.S. Post Office. They investigate mail fraud. They investigate theft of checks from the mail. They investigate postal employees who are committing crimes.
Your dad cracked a big, he's probably cracked many big cases. Tell us about that one you told us about in Green Room.
My dad worked in Alabama in probably the late 1920s, and at the time he started, one had to be a postal clerk or carrier before you were even eligible. So he delivered mail in Hazleton, Pennsylvania first, and then he went to Alabama, and I don't know how large the case was, but it was a case in Alabama. It had stumped people for quite some time, and he always sadly said, the reason I cracked it was that there were some black farm workers who were kind of sitting on the side of the road, and he went up and talked to them and asked them what they thought happened, and they gave him the clues to what had happened in this theft. And I think, sadly, it was because he was a white northerner who would talk to these folks. I'm also proud to say when he became the chief postal inspector in Philadelphia, he hired the first African-American and women postal inspectors in the country.
Wow. He sounds like a guy who you could learn a lot from.
Yes.
Yeah. You talked about letters, literally letters. There was an event in your life involving a particular letter which was pivotal, not just for you but for the country. Tell us about that.
I became Deputy Sergeant at Arms in the United States Senate on October 15th, 2001.
Would you repeat that title again and just in a few seconds? What is that?
Deputy Sergeant at Arms in the Senate. The Sergeant at Arms office is the administrative arm of the Senate, and we were responsible for everything from cleaning the Senate wing of the Capitol to the most sophisticated computer security systems and supporting computers, telephones, and equipment in the Senate.
So you're Deputy Sergeant at Arms.
I'm Deputy Sergeant at Arms.
Day one.
Obviously, September 11th was only about a month away. And my boss, now U.S. Ambassador to Tanzania, Al Lenhart, said, well, we've got a lot of security issues we have to deal with. I'm going to take the security side, and I need you to take care of everything else. And I was not there 3 hours when the anthrax letter was opened in Senator Daschle's office. And so I was instant command, and my first day lasted about 3.5 months.
How did that start? You were sitting in your office, and what happened?
I was sitting in my office. I was getting ready to be sworn in. In that particular job, you're sworn in both as Deputy Sergeant at Arms in the Senate and as a member of the Capitol Police Board. So I've got two swearings in to attend to and some pretty immediate personnel actions that were waiting for signature. So we walked. At the time that we started this trek across the Capitol complex, we knew there was a letter and it was being investigated, but the expectation at the time was that it would be a fake or a false alarm. By the time I got from the Capitol to the Hart Building, I got sworn in the Senate, signed the personnel papers, and by the time we finished, we knew we were in a building where anthrax was, in fact, present. So I never made it over to the Capitol Police headquarters for a couple months to get. I was there for meetings, but I wasn't there to get sworn in for quite some time. So that's how it happened. I was not there 3 hours, literally.
Any regrets about taking the job, saying, my goodness, what did I get myself into?
The only, I do ruefully ask myself, I was sort of in the final stages of interviewing for that job on September 17th and 18th. And I do occasionally ask myself, what was I thinking? But no, I never regretted the job. It was a provenance that the right people were there at that time to deal with what was a very difficult situation and could have been even more tragic than it was.
A very, very important job, obviously, you had. What's the best job you've ever had?
The best job I ever had was being chief of staff to Attorney General Janet Reno.
To who?
Attorney General Janet Reno.
Wow. That was the best job.
That was absolutely the best job.
Why?
And I've had some great jobs.
Why?
Because the Attorney General brought an incredible level of commitment to the job, and she, in many ways, transformed the Department of Justice. She had high standards for quality herself. She never lost sight of her sense of humor. She demanded the best of all of us.
Whoa, hold on a second. Janet Reno had a sense of humor?
She did.
And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but I think most people, when they picture Janet Reno, they think of a very tall, stern, commanding, sober presence. And you're telling us there's another side to her.
Well, she is all of those things. But she's an incredibly intelligent woman and has a wonderful sense of humor. You just have to watch her with kids, for example, and you see a completely different person. The other thing is, even when she was Attorney General and dealing with the most sophisticated, complicated legal questions and national security questions, even in that situation, if you traveled with her and went around the country, walked through a shopping center with her, she was a rock star.
What kind of issues did you deal with when you're, I mean, chief of staff of the Department of Justice, there's all kinds of big issues you're dealing with. What were some of the key ones you worked on?
I worked on the Wen Ho Lee investigation. I worked on the Elian Gonzalez rescue. I worked on tons of ethical investigations and questions, all of the independent counsel questions, all of the oversight. At that time, too, there were attempts on the Hill to hold the Attorney General in contempt. It was never a dull moment.
In many ways, you followed in the spirit of your dad's footsteps.
Yes.
What does your dad think of you?
Well, unfortunately, my dad did not live to see me in that position, but I know he would have been very proud.
Yeah. Would you give us the web address, please, for the National Crime Prevention Council?
Yes, it's www.ncpc.org.
Okay, give it to us one more time. I want to make sure everybody gets it.
NCPC, as in National Crime Prevention Council, ncpc.org.
Perfect. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Ann Harkins. Ann is the president and CEO of the National Crime Prevention Council. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ted Sullivan of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders just like Ann. And we will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
John Tittle.
John, who are you with?
I'm with Convene.
What is Convene?
Convene is a national organization of CEO peer group, roundtable, CEO roundtable, Christian business leaders who come together to help each other deal with their business issues.
How do they help each other?
In forum days where we get together for a day, we work together around what's really going on in a trusted, safe environment where you can bring issues that you might not have any other place that you can really talk it through.
When you say safe and trusted, what do you mean?
Well, let me give you an example. One of our members came with an issue that they needed to, their starting place was, I think I need to restructure the positions in my board.
Yeah.
And so we explored that issue. At the end of the discussion, I asked the group, so what's the real issue? Ah, key insight. Where we started was not the real issue. It actually was the people weren't performing, and the group said, you don't need to change the position descriptions. You need to fire those folks and get the people who'll do what you need to do. I mean, this is not an issue that this person would have been able to work with her board, right?
Right.
So took that recommendation, worked that through, huge, huge impact on the organization.
Who's a good candidate for a peer group like this?
Somebody who's in the hot seat. You have to find that balance of strategy, performance, delivery, people, all the rest of it. And you're ready, you're trying to drive things to make things different, and you realize you need some help.
How do we get a hold of you, John?
ConveneNow.com.
ConveneNow.com. We've been speaking with John Tittle of Convene, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Ted Sullivan, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. And we're thrilled to introduce you to our next guest. His name is Jeff Studley. Jeff is the co-founder and president of CPR Multimedia Solutions. So, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
And what is CPR Multimedia Solutions?
Well, CPR Multimedia Solutions is a provider of sound, lights, and video for live events. And we take people's ideas and message and bring it to the public in an exciting way that gets their message across.
So I get the events part. You know, I can think of lights and all of the staging, that sort of thing. But what are you talking about getting people's message across?
Well, the reason people have events is because they want to excite people. They want to sell something to people. They want to spread the word about something. And in Washington, D.C., it's often a political message or a concept that they want to take and bring to the public. And so one of the things that we need to do is excite people to go away from an event thinking about the message that was supposed to be gotten across, as opposed to what did they have for dinner or who was the entertainment.
Are all events pretty much the same?
No. Events vary a lot in what the end goal is and what the message is being shared, and the venues dictate events a lot.
Yeah. You said that the hardest part of an event is making it look easy. What did you mean by that?
Well, the three-hour event takes months of planning, lots of days and or hours of load in time, and prepping all of the different players whose usually main job or goal in life is not being at that event, and they're being brought in from some other direction. So if you have people at a lectern speaking, they probably don't do this often, and you have to make them feel comfortable. You have to make them hit the cue. You have to make them put their mouth right up to the mic, like
yeah.
I am right now.
Did you feel sometimes like you're almost a director or a producer of some sort of choreographed thing, and you've got all these things to account for as the event is unfolding?
Very much so. And on jobs, we have specifically producers or directors for roles, but orchestrating the event as a whole is a production.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we do.
How long have you been doing this?
24 years.
What were some of the maybe more memorable or unusual or maybe even more famous events that you've done? Any we'd recognize?
Without a doubt. One of the most memorable was providing the large screens on the outside of the Pentagon on October 11th, 1 month after the building was hit by a plane during the 9/11 attacks, and going through and doing the site survey literally 2 weeks after the attack when there was still smoke coming from some of the rubble, and being individually escorted into the facility for the site survey and being told everybody gets an escort, an armed escort.
Yeah.
If you lose your escort, you will be shot. And so that was a very nerve-wracking thing, and we realized the import of the event. And it's one of our proudest moments at CPR, helping to dedicate, you know, the solemnity of what went on there and send a message to the American people that, you know, we were going to rise above that.
Tell us about growing up and whether there were any formative elements in your upbringing that crafted an entrepreneur.
Well, growing up in my family with a lot of people that were lawyers by training, but all ended up being entrepreneurs and business owners by desire, sort of set my career path early, I think. I always assumed I was going to own a business or run a business. I just pictured that from when I was very young, and it was a course I was set on by my surroundings.
When you were little or young and you thought about owning a business, what did you think of? What did it seem like it would be like?
It was following in my dad's footsteps a lot, going into work, and I would often go with him to his offices. He was a general manager and owner, part owner of a propane business, but he would talk to all the employees, find out what was going on. I felt that it was an important thing to be able to know everything about the operation you were involved in and make the hard decisions. seemed like a good place to be.
And you told us in the green room that in addition to your parents and grandparents, you had other models growing up for the entrepreneurial.
Well, in my neighborhood, all of the kids I grew up with seemed to have dads that, even if they were sole proprietorships, were all their own boss. There was a plumber or an electronics TV store owner or a guy who was an insurance broker. And everybody's dad seemed to be independent businessmen. It just seemed like, you know, the milieu I grew up in.
So it seemed natural. And then you got into business yourself, but it wasn't multimedia. Where'd you start out?
Well, having grown up in the Sullivan County Catskills in New York, all of my summer jobs were busboy, waiter, bellhop, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to be a business owner of when I got out of high school, so it was a natural progression to go to hotel school because that's what I had been doing for years.
And that took you where?
Well, I went to Cornell Hotel School, and when I graduated, I moved to Manhattan because I interviewed with Hyatt. And about midway through the interview, I was getting this unease, and I asked the interviewer, I said, so if I'm on the management track, how many times am I going to move in the first 10 years? And the fellow looked at me and he said, probably 10. And the next day I canceled my interview with Marriott, and I canceled my interview with Sheraton.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm just going to go to New York because that's where restaurants and hotels are.
So, you know, the image maybe some of us have is, so you were running like Studio 54 or something like that, some high-profile, sexy celebrities everywhere. Is that the kind of life you lived?
I one of the reasons I got out of the restaurant business was because of that sort of lifestyle. I did go to Studio 54. I did run an Upper East Side restaurant that had a lot of sports celebrities come in. I had a number of New York Jets and New York Rangers and New York Giants come through, and it was a lot of fun, but the drinking started early and went late, and you worked 7 days a week. And when an opportunity came through my cousin to get involved in a completely different business outside of New York City, it seemed like a good opportunity. It would be a notable turning point.
How did you guard against, or did you guard against, sort of thinking a lot of yourself, like, hey, I'm hanging out with the Jets and the Giants and whomever. How'd you deal with that?
Oh, I totally succumbed. it was one of the crazy aspects of being in New York at that time in that business that it was a very cool area. The Upper East Side was where all the coolest bars were, and celebrities came in and out all the time, and it's seductive.
Yeah, but, so some people are saying, well, what's not to like about that? Well, what was not to like about it?
It's not a sustainable lifestyle.
What do you mean?
The drinking, the level of effort, the burnout, and back in the late 70s and early 80s, it was cool to party constantly. We would get out of work on a Saturday night at 2 in the morning, go to an after-hours club, and walk out at daylight. Go home and shower and go back to work. And
wow.
It's a tough lifestyle.
And you got a call from your cousin, and what did he tell you?
He said, there's something coming called computer projection, data display. And I said, what's that? And he sort of described the fact that computers were going to start outputting more of their information visually instead of printed. And because he was in the electronics industry down here in the D.C. area where the first demand for this was, government agencies, DOD, et cetera, we took a look at it, put a business plan together, and it made a lot of sense.
Were you ready for that phone call, meaning you're ready to go, you're ready to do something different, or was there a little convincing?
There wasn't a lot of convincing. As soon as we looked at the business plan and it made financial sense, I was sure I'm there. What was unexpected was that originally I was going to still be doing restaurant consulting in New York, and I'd come down every 2 weeks, do the operations back end kind of stuff because he was the technologist front end guy. But after my second trip down, I was all of a sudden commuting back and forth on the Eastern Shuttle and spending 5 days a week in D.C. and the weekend at home.
Yeah. Well, what's one of the hard things about running a business?
People. And in my business, we are very people-oriented. Labor is a big component of what we bill, and our ratio of people to dollars generated is very high. So we're a people company, and everything we do is labor intensive. So managing people is the toughest thing.
Do you have to fire them sometimes?
I do. And I always fire people at my company myself because I think that's a CEO or a president's responsibility. I don't like to delegate that, but it's not a pleasant thing, except on rare occasion where someone really deserves it.
Can you tell us about one time you had to fire somebody? It was tough. It took a toll on you.
I had a young fellow who worked really hard for us. He was a good growth candidate, but he had a lot of personal problems and just couldn't. And when he was there at work, he did a great job, yeah, and he gave it his all. But he was too unreliable to continue working for us, and I just had to let him go because we're a team effort, and you can't have one guy letting the rest of the team down.
Was it tough to do that?
Yes, it's very tough. Yeah. And I looked at his personal situation, and I probably shouldn't do that when I fire people or consider disciplining or terminating them, but it's hard not to imagine the impact it's going to have on that person and their family.
Yeah.
It makes it more complicated.
In just a few words, the most meaningful part of what you do is what?
Support people in accomplishing their goals. We are a service company, and so we're always happy when a client comes back to us and says, "You made me look good."
Yeah. Would you give us the web address, please, for CPR Multimedia Solutions?
www.cprmms.com. Okay. And I always say, "Mary, Mary, Sam," so people don't write NNS.
So CPRMMS.com.
That's it.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Jeff Studley. Jeff is the co-founder and president of CPR Multimedia Solutions. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ted Sullivan, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, and we will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Larry Fox.
Larry, who are you with?
The Values Group.
What is the Values Group?
It's a company dedicated to creating business plans.
What type of business plans? Something special about your business plans?
Yes, we're very practical. We say we're practical and tactical, and that leads to success.
Well, what does that mean, practical and tactical?
It's one thing to say you're strategic. It's more important from a bank's perspective or an investor's perspective that you know how to accomplish a mission. That's tactical.
Yeah. Give us an example of a success story.
Easy example, we recently had a company that came to us seeking a $5 million loan. It had been turned down by 8 banks. After we did its business plan, it received 5 offers and actually could have gotten a 6th.
So tell us how they could have gotten the 6th.
The 6th bank asked for the newest economic information, and the company, by the time it had assembled that, said, literally, who cares? We've already got 5 offers.
So they went from 0 to 8 to 6, potentially 6 for 6.
Yes.
How did you do that? Like, what's the secret sauce to what you do?
The secret sauce is we persuaded all the banks that this company's business had an unlimited opportunity or future.
You love doing this kind of stuff, don't you?
Absolutely.
Why?
Makes me a lifelong learner, and I like to help people.
So how does a business or a future entrepreneur get a hold of you?
www.thevaluesgroupllc.com.
So that's values, plural.
Yes.
Valuesgroupllc.com.
Yes.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Larry Fox of The Values Group. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Ted Sullivan, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. And we're excited to introduce to you our second guest. His name's Jim Boland, and Jim is the president of Boland. So welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you, Mike.
And besides being your last name, what is Boland?
Boland's a company that is a professional services company that, to put it in a real succinct thing, it makes buildings better, either with products, services, controls, or solutions.
Okay. It also makes us comfortable, does it not?
It sure does.
How?
Well, we have a saying, we're not comfortable until you are.
And we may have seen that where?
on trucks, on billboards, in magazines. So we try and promote that.
Yeah. So you make us comfortable. How? Is it as simple as air conditioning in buildings, or does it go way beyond that?
Well, it's partially air conditioning, but when you talk about air conditioning, we also do the controls and other things to your building that makes it a better environment.
So that's, I guess, from my perspective, I don't own a building, but I work in a building. What about somebody who owns a building and their concern about energy efficiency? What do you guys do?
That's the future of our business. It's about energy services. It's making buildings more efficient. We look at energy as a red, white, and blue issue. And the reason why we're so excited about it is that we think that we can make buildings better every day.
Well, when you say red, white, and blue issue, what do you mean?
Well, red, white, and blue because our country is has been struggling with energy the last 35 years, at least since OPEC got its act together. And we're trying to make buildings more efficient so we don't use as much fossil fuels.
How big or small, by whatever measure?
We're about 325 people. We got about 150 trucks on the road. We're a regional company.
And the company was founded when?
Company was founded in 1960 by my father, Lou Bolin.
Yeah, you said that air conditioning wasn't the only thing you do, but that it was a really important part of the company. Can you tell us about how it all started?
Well, air conditioning is very, very important. I can tell you how it started first, and what I'll talk about that is a little bit. It really started with my father.
What's your dad's first name?
My father's name is Lou Bolin, and my father passed away in 2003. But 1953, he was in the Navy. He was a Naval Academy graduate, had his own ship, was doing pretty good, and had three kids, wanted to have more kids, and looked at the potential of having more kids and said, I got to do something different. I can't stay in the Navy. So he read a magazine on Time Magazine about the little giant air conditioning company called the Train Company in La Crosse, Wisconsin, and decided to leave the military at that point. He had had three kids. He ended up having eight kids. And went about becoming a commission salesman, selling train equipment in the Washington, D.C. area.
Why that, as opposed to doing something else? Do you know?
My father was an entrepreneur. And being a commission salesman, it puts you in control of your own destiny. So he wanted to be able to go out there and do whatever he could do with his talents.
Did you work for Dad growing up as a youngster?
Yeah. I officially have 34 years with Bolin, but I'll tell you my real age, it's 56. And a lot of people accuse me of working for the company for 56 years. So yeah. It's been great. I can remember as a young kid delivering pamphlets to homes back when we used to do residential air conditioning. And it started with working in the parts department, working in the service department in high school and college, fixing large commercial air conditioning systems. So been doing it a long time.
When you went over this in the green room, meaning talking about growing up working with Dad, you were glowing. I mean, you were literally glowing. Why?
My father was a very special guy, not just being one of eight kids, but he had an effect on people. He made people better, to be quite honest with you. Just by being around him, if you're a member of the train organization, back in the day, he taught them all how to get into the service business and do things. And he was kind of the John Wayne of air conditioning in his day. So
that means what?
That means a leader. I mean, he taught people how to be good businessmen, how to be good parents, how to be good citizens.
Was he a different person to you as dad versus as boss? Or was he the same guy?
No. He was good at shifting. He knew when it was business, it was business. When you're a kid growing up, sometimes you need a different perspective, maybe an ear, maybe a sympathetic ear once in a while. And he was good at that. He was very good at that.
Well, how was it that he was able to switch back and forth? And how was it able? Were you able to switch back and forth as son versus employee?
You know, I remember talking to my dad about that as a kid, and his biggest dream growing up was to have a big family. And having eight kids, I think, you know, if you ask him what was the most important thing in his life, it was being a father and raising eight kids.
Yeah. You said that you're living the dream.
I am living the dream.
What's the dream?
The dream of, one, I had a great childhood, but being able to work with a true entrepreneur through my life, watching a mentor, making a difference in the business community has been living the dream. And I think we offer a service to the community that is not only good and necessary, but essential. So that's a lot of fun to be part of that.
How old were you, or when did you know what you wanted to do, that you wanted to stay in the business? And did you ever think about doing anything else?
Great question. I really didn't think I was going to go in the family business. About my senior year in college, my father started recruiting me a little bit, and getting into the Train engineering program for 6 months really helped with that. So I decided late my senior year to go in. At that point, I had a brother in the business and an uncle. Thought maybe there were too many Bolins around. I was a little worried about that, but it was a great decision, and I really proud of that.
You never thought about doing anything else?
No. Once I got into the business, I mean, the people are great, the company's great, the culture's great. I can't dream of doing anything else than what I'm doing today.
Okay. What happened to Dad in 2003?
Dad got cancer at age 78, and it was 90 days, tough spell, but that took him out.
90 days between diagnosis and him passing away?
Yeah, lymphatic cancer, and it was quick. It was not real long, but you know, pretty sudden.
What were you doing at the time?
Working.
as what?
I was the operations manager of the company in those days, and it was over a summer. Basically, my father got a cancer. We thought we could get it remission. It happened that it did take his life.
Well, when did you know you were going to be president?
That's a great question too. I think we always talked about that. We talked about the fact that at some point I would take over, but it wasn't anything that we were planning on when my father passed.
How did you focus on the business and focus on your dad passing?
Well,
how'd you do both?
I think everybody in life has those periods of moments of truth that they go through, and those were my 90 days of making sure my dad was okay and the business was okay.
What was it like to tell us, recreate for us, the first day on the job after your dad passed?
I remember it well. My brother, actually, who works with me, brought us all out on the loading dock.
His name's Lou.
Lou. That's Lou Jr. And we informed everybody that my father had passed. He informed everybody that I was going to take over as president, and that business as usual. And Big Lou would want us to go back to work and do the best we can.
Wow. So it's you and your brother who are still in the business,
right?
How come you have seven siblings? How come you two, rather than the others?
That's a great question. I think my father was smart in that, he never wanted to put everyone at risk in one business. So we all got great educations, courtesy of my father and courtesy of the company. So we've got lawyers and businessmen and everything else in the family. So two of us went into it.
Was there something unique about you that you really had a
I think I'm the best looking in the family. Other than that, I don't know.
We will have the siblings on and ask them their opinion on that. You have a colleague here named Karen. Who is Karen?
Karen is our marketing leader in the company, and Karen's been with us for over 20 years, and she's a great part of the family.
Karen used to work for the company. She left to start a family,
right,
and she came back years later. And she told us in the green room, you were the only company that she would consider working for. Well, why do you think she feels that way?
Well, you'd have to ask Karen. She's right here. But I will say this. Once you're at Bolin, it is family. It's very much a family company, even though we've grown over the years. That probably is more important to us than I think any single attribute at the company.
Yeah. She Karen also mentioned that the company really cares about people, and she talked about the Cristo Rey School.
Don Bosco Cristo Rey. It's one of our missions that we help support. I think initially we had about 16 kids working at the company part time. How they pay for their private high school education by working one day a week.
Why do you do that?
I think it's important that any company in the community gives back, and education is big in us. We also support the Washington Jesuit Academy, which is a 6th through 8th grade school down in the district.
You said earlier you're living the dream. Are you living Dad's dream? Are you living your dream? Both of your dreams?
I think I'm living both, to be honest with you. I think my dad would be very proud that the company has continued on and is continuing to grow and flourish. I've always wanted to be involved in business, and the fact that I get to to be involved in the leadership of a business is very important to me.
Would you give us the web address for Boland, please, Jim?
www.boland.com. Pretty
spell
easy.
Spell it for us.
BOLAND.com.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Jim Boland. Jim is the president of Boland. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ted Sullivan, of the law firm Buchanan Ingersoll & Rooney, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders just like Jim. And we will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight.
Thank you, Mike. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380 or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Ted Sullivan, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And we are thrilled to introduce to you our final guest of the day. His name is Chris Bergen, and Chris is the president, CEO, and publisher of Tax Analysts. So welcome to the show, Chris.
Nice to be here.
And what is Tax Analysts?
Tax Analysts is a nonprofit organization that works to improve tax policy and tax administration at the federal, state, and international levels.
Can you give us an example?
I'll give you the most specific example is that the Internal Revenue Service likes to operate in relative secrecy, choosing my words carefully. They, for years, issue private rulings. Back starting in 1972, our organization tried to convince them and succeeded in convincing them with the court's assistance and using the Freedom of Information Act to release their administrative law to the public. Prior to that, it was only inside the IRS. And so for the last 40 years, we have worked to convince the IRS that transparency is good for a tax system.
So the average taxpayer is better off because of that. How?
The average taxpayer is better off because the law, the people's law, is in the people's hands. Anybody can get access to these rulings now.
Wow. Are you a tax revolutionary?
I suppose you could look at the organization back in the 1970s as a tax revolutionary. We're a little more part of the establishment now. Yeah. We, because of our efforts, we try to work more collaboratively with the Internal Revenue Service than before. However, we have taken our transparency efforts to the states now. And I would imagine some of the states will view our requests that they make some of their law more public as revolutionary.
You mentioned in the green room that you have a record of 7-1-1.
That, I believe, is our record
against,
in courts.
Against whom?
Against the Internal Revenue Service and the federal government.
That's a pretty good record.
It includes a win in the Supreme Court.
Wow. A lot of people out there would like to give you a high five right now. How long have you been doing this?
At Tax Analysts?
Yes.
21 years.
Okay. And is it safe to say that you love thinking and writing and talking about taxes?
It is safe to say that. I started my career almost 30 years ago, 30 years next month, thinking and writing about tax. I love tax.
So you do realize that you might as well be from Mars, because most people do not like that at all.
It's interesting thing. In my world, I'm not the geek. In my world of tax lawyers and tax economists and tax policymakers, that's all we talk about.
When did you first know that you loved tax?
My second year in law school.
What happened?
We were required to take a tax course. There were two professors, quite honestly, who taught. There was a young woman who taught the code, and there was an older man who taught case law. Now, most of the students were intimidated with tax and went to the professor who taught the case law because that's what they were used to. I took a chance and went to learn the code, and after a semester with her, I was in love with tax law.
In love with what exactly? I mean, does your mind just work differently than everybody else's?
I find it fascinating. I find it complex. At the time, I found that it had a symmetry to it. That's long gone. But remember, I'm taking tax before what was called the Economic Recovery Tax Act of 1981, which was Reagan's first tax change. Since 81 till now, they haven't left the law alone for probably any more than 2 years. I found it like detective work, trying to figure out how transactions work, how they're taxed, how they might not be taxed. I actually thought I would head off in the direction of helping corporations minimize their taxes. I found that game fascinating because tax avoidance is not wrong. That's what tax lawyers do. They minimize taxes.
Right.
Tax evasion is a crime. That's not what lawyers do.
Yes.
It took a strange twist, and I ended up writing about taxes because I took my two loves together, writing, taxes, and put them together.
Were you a normal child?
Well, some might disagree, but it was a fairly normal childhood.
Tell us about growing up.
Probably the most significant part of my growing up was my mom died when I was 9 years old. The older I've gotten, the more I've realized what an effect it has on a person. And I think it helps in some strange way mold your leadership abilities.
Yeah. What happened with mom?
My understanding is, and my father never talked about it, it was a huge blow to him. He was a young man with three small children, 9, 7, and 2. My understanding from talking to relatives is she had a very aggressive form of brain cancer and died at a very young age. I believe she was 41.
Yeah. Tell us about dad before mom died.
My father went to the United States Naval Academy because he had no other choice. They were a poor family. It was either that kind of an education or he wasn't going to college. He was in World War II. He was a PT boat commander and a war hero, won the Silver Star.
For doing what?
I don't know. He never talked about it, and I decided when he died in 2008 that I would eventually go find out exactly what he did.
Yeah.
But from what I've heard from other people, it involved killing people.
Yeah.
There was a firefight, and a lot of people died. None on his boat.
So your dad is a war hero.
Yes.
And he's married to your mom, and there's three young children. You mentioned in the green room that you had a lot to live up to. What did you mean by that?
He was a great leader. He was a great business executive. He's a war hero. In high school, his high school yearbook's ridiculous. He's the most likely to succeed. He's the best looking. I mean, it's unbelievable. And his whole life was one that a lot of people admired. And I think the thing they admired most about him was not only was he successful, he was a fair leader, and he was a humble man.
What happened when your mom died?
Changed him forever.
How so?
Well, I think she was, they were clearly, I can remember even a small child, deeply in love. And she had a huge influence on his life. He was a tough guy. He's a big, tough Irishman. And she smoothed the edges. Yeah. And they came back after she left us. The edges.
And what sort of impact did that have on you?
Well, it changed me forever. Again, I think some of the leadership abilities come from that. I'm the oldest of the three sons. My father sort of checked out. He traveled a lot on business. We had a slew of governesses. But I was sort of responsible for my brothers. And later on, when my dad remarried, he had three daughters. Then I became responsible for five siblings.
You grew up pretty fast.
You had to.
Yeah. Yet you left for California after college to find yourself?
That's what I said. Yeah, that doesn't make much sense. But yeah, I think a lot of people left to find themselves. I don't think I was quite ready to grow up. And I like manual labor. And when I got to California, I worked in warehouses. I lugged around laminated plastic that most people know as Formica, which is a brand name. I drove trucks. I drove forklifts. I like sweating.
In fact, you said, quote, "I think of myself as a ditch digger." What do you mean?
I've taken some heat for that statement. I'm proud of the fact that I've done a lot of manual labor work. When I was a junior in college, I actually worked at a copper mine in Arizona and literally dug ditches. I sandblasted. I did a lot of other things. I am not ashamed of the fact that I've worked manual labor. I'm very proud of it.
But something happened that ended that. What was that?
I was on my way to work in California, and I was literally hit by a truck. And I took some very severe injuries. And the worst of them was I broke my neck. And I broke it between the first and second cervical vertebrae. So they were pretty sure when I came in the ambulance that I was going to be a quadriplegic.
What happened?
I'm not a quadriplegic.
Why not?
I don't know. There's two things in my life that I have to believe the answer to these questions. My wife tells me the answer to these questions are my mother. How come I could still walk? I was lucky. And in business, I often know what to do. And I don't know how I know what to do. And my wife says that's my mother.
What do you mean you know what to do?
I have a very good vision for where the business should go. And I have a very good track record on my visions.
What does your wife mean when she says that's your mother?
It's coming from some place that I don't understand, but she thinks it's spiritual.
Is this something you do, tax analyst, something you do because you just love taxes, or is this a cause that you have a heart for?
It's a cause that I have a heart for. I came to tax analyst temporarily and met the founder. I'm the only other president of the company other than the founder. And I believed in his mission. His basic mission is to serve the country.
Yeah. Well, one thing tax analyst publish in order to support the policy goals. We didn't ask this, but how big is it, and when was it founded?
The organization was founded in 1970. We've got about 190 employees in a relatively new office building, which is another one of our accomplishments, all together. And then we've got stringers from around the world. Our publications, the best way I can describe our publications is that our publications are very top policy magazines and web publications. The way I like to describe it is that we sell into the 95 of the top 100 law firms in the country. And then I always say, ask me why we don't sell into the other five. They don't do tax.
What is the single biggest injustice related to tax that you would like to change before your time is over?
Well, I don't know if we're going to change it before my time is over, but I think we got an illustration today. Whether you favor health care reform or you don't favor health care reform, it's another example, the mandate, of the lawmakers in Congress picking winners and losers through the tax system. So we're going to punish, to enforce the mandate, and that's the right word, people. We do the same thing. Here's a good example. I own a home, and I get to deduct the mortgage interest. You may rent an apartment. You don't get that. Why am I better than you? And the code is riddled with examples like this.
Why, in just a few words, we're almost out of time, but I want to know, why does that bother you so much? Why does that burn inside of your heart?
It's not fair. When you lose your mother at 9 years old, fairness becomes very important to something you can't explain. That's what drives me.
Wow. Would you give us the web address for tax analysts, please?
I give you two, taxanalyst.com. Which is our subscription-based site, and tax.com, which is free.
Okay, so I want to make sure everybody gets those. Tax analysts, just like it sounds.
Right.
Spell out the two words,
.com.
And the other one?
Easier, tax.com.
Tax.com.
Mm-hmm. If you want to know what I think of the decision today, I put a post up there already.
Got it. Thank you. We've been speaking with Chris Bergen. Chris is the president, CEO, and publisher of Tax Analysts. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ted Sullivan, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, for helping me with the interview. I'd like to thank all of our guests today. Ann Harkins, President and CEO of the National Crime Prevention Council. Jim Boland, President of Boland. Jeff Studley, Co-Founder and President of CPR Multimedia Solutions. And, of course, most recently, Chris Bergen, President, CEO, and Publisher of Tax Analysts. More than anyone else, I'd like to thank you, our listening audience. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't even have a radio show. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you to the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce for hosting us. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders, just like Chris. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions signing off. And again, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility.